नमो विष्णुपादाय कृष्ण पृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्ति वेदांता स्वामी इति नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य देशतारिणे वांचा कल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिंधुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौर भक्त वृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। Hare Krishna. So today we continue our discussion on the Bhagavad Gita and we'll discuss the 12th chapter. Now the 12th, yesterday I discussed how the significance of the 11th chapter can be understood from one perspective by looking at its length. It is the third longest chapter. It is followed by the 12th chapter, and the 12th and the 15th chapters. These two are the Is this visible? Let me try changing the colors. We don't have any lights. Those of you who are not able to see, maybe you may want to come closer or just change your location a little bit and see if that helps you to. Sorry? Is this better? So, chapters 12 and 15, they have 20 verses each. Both of them are the shortest chapters. So now if we take it forward, at one level, yesterday I talked about how if you look at the Bhagavad Gita structure, it is like this. It is, say, 1 to 6, or rather, 6 is the ending. So 7, 13, 18, not proportionate. So from Karma Yoga to Bhakti Yoga is being talked about. The central section is Bhakti Yoga. So this chapter is the last part of the Bhakti Yoga section. Now, overall, the way the Gita analyzes the Bhakti Yoga. So, like yesterday, I'll be focusing more on the significance of the chapter, and then we will discuss the content of that chapter in the light of the significance. So, the Gita, when it talks about Bhakti Yoga, it has a multi-pronged approach. See, generally, say, if this is a target and this is a bullseye, so we might shoot an arrow and it hits the bullseye like this. That's nice. And we might shoot multiple arrows and one after another they keep hitting the bullseye like that. However, another way is that if you really want to see the expertise of a person shooting the arrows, then it's not just shooting the bullseye from the front. Can they shoot from here and hit the bullseye? Can they shoot from here and hit the bullseye? Can they shoot from here, from the bottom, and hit the bullseye? Can they shoot from above and hit the bullseye? So what happens is, if the same target is hit from multiple directions, that indicates a far greater level of expertise. So similarly, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has a particular contextual purpose. So the bullseye for Krishna is the contextual purpose. There is a universal purpose of the Gita, which we'll come to later. The contextual purpose is, Krishna wants Arjuna to fight, to assist in the establishment of dharma. So Krishna broadly talks about four paths, karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, bhakti yoga. Here I'm not putting them in a hierarchy. And he also talks about karma kanda to some extent. And through all these, he arrives at the same point that Arjuna, you should fight. So for example, 231 to 38, 37. Krishna says, it is karma kanda. You fight and win, you will go to heaven. If you fight and win, you will get the earth. If you fight and die, you will get heaven. So where is the loss? Tasma uttishta kaunte yuddhaya krutanishchaya. Similarly, when Krishna talks about karma yoga, obviously that involves doing work. And he says, nishreyas. Better than a person who is a false renunciate is a person who is engaging their senses. So for example, Krishna talks about this in the third chapter, as well as the fifth chapter, in many verses. Now, Krishna, what he says is, as far as Dhyan Yoga is concerned, yes, in Dhyan Yoga, there is a stage for renouncing the world. But there is a stage for preparing oneself for renunciation. And Krishna urges Arjuna to function at that stage. So, yes, Dhyan Yoga involves renunciation, but he, in the Dhyan Yoga chapter, sixth chapter, initially there are a lot of sections about controlling the mind, about the mind. So, 6 point up to say 9 is 6.1 to 9. What it does is, it is talking about the Aruruksha and Arudha stage, the initial and the eventual stage. And Krishna says in the initial stage, one should perform one's duty and practice yoga as a part of one's sadhana while doing one's duty. Similarly, in the 18th chapter, when Krishna talks about Jnana Yoga, there also he says Jnana Yoga needs to be preceded by functioning in the world. So specifically, he talks about Jnana Yoga from 49 to 54. But before that, he talks about how to become qualified to practice Jnana Yoga, one needs to be purified. And that purification will come from the engaged state. And of course, as far as Bhakti Yoga is concerned, Krishna says Bhakti Yoga is a yoga of action. Therefore, he should do his duty. Most famously, this is 8.7. Again, 11.33. 8.7 is Ma Manusmara Yudhyacha. And 11.33 is Tasmatam Uttishta Yasho Labhasva. Therefore, arise and attain victory. So, in this way, Krishna is actually hitting the same bullseye from multiple perspectives. Now, interestingly, Krishna doesn't just do this for the point of that Arjuna should fight, but even from the perspective of the practice of Bhakti Yoga. See, sometimes people say that the Bhagavad Gita teaches different things to different people. It talks about Karma Yoga for those who are interested in Karma Yoga, those who are interested in action. It talks about Bhakti Yoga for those who are more sentimental and more emotional. Well, there is some truth to that. See, the Bhagavad Gita is inclusive. It does not explicitly condemn any path. It does not, even Karma Kanda, it does not condemn. It says, avipaschitaha. Those people are not very discerning. And we'll see this inclusiveness in this 12th chapter when Krishna will talk about the impersonal aspect. Though it is inclusive, that does not mean it is inconclusive. Inclusive means it accepts various paths. But that does not mean there is no conclusion to the Gita's message. That it doesn't mean that the Gita itself does not recommend a particular path. This conclusiveness is seen in very explicitly in 1866. Where Krishna is telling, put aside everything else that I have told you, sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. So, the Gita is inclusive and it is also conclusive, both. Now, in the sixth chapter, in the middle six chapters, where Krishna is focusing on Bhakti Yoga, how does he hit the bullseye from multiple perspectives? So, we see technically speaking, in the sixth chapter, in 33 and 34, and then again 37 to 39, Arjuna expresses apprehension, fear about the practice of Dhyan Yoga, and especially specifically about the aspect of controlling the mind. This is Chanchalami Mana Krishna Pramathi Balavadrudam. So when Arjuna expresses apprehension, Krishna empathizes with him, Asamshayam Mahabaho. But Krishna does not, in one sense, reject Dhyan Yoga. His answer is very generic. Abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagyena cha gruhyate. So these two, Abhyasa and Vairagya, in one sense are required for any path. We could talk about Abhyasa and Vairagya in medical terms. In medical terms, a person is sick, then there is a prescription, there are prescriptions, and there are proscriptions. What you should do and what you should not do, what you should stay away from. So this is required for any path. So Krishna does not reject Dhyan Yoga. At the same time, he talks about a broad principle that can be applied in different ways. So then Krishna conclude that chapter, Dhyan Yoga chapter, the sixth chapter starts from Karma Yoga, the major initial, that means the person is practicing Karma Yoga, and the major part of the chapter is Dhyan Yoga. And then after that, and it culminates in Bhakti Yoga. Of course, there are some verses which talk about Bhakti Yoga in between also, 30 and then 31, where Mam comes quite prominently. Yo Mam Pashyati Sarvatra. But 47 is very clearly Bhakti Yoga. So now what is happening after this is that Krishna addresses Arjuna's question thereafter. So from the process of Karma Yoga to Dhyan Yoga to Bhakti Yoga, and the culmination of Dhyan Yoga is to have the mind fixed on me. That yoginam api sarvesham madgatina antaratma. Now in the seventh chapter, Krishna says, now I will teach you an alternative way to fix the mind on me. And mai asakta manaha partha yogam yunjan madashraya asamshayam samagram mam yatha gyansisi tashrunu. So he's telling here, so the 647 was fix mind on Krishna. So fix on Krishna. And that is through the gradual elevation from Karma Yoga, Dhyan Yoga to Bhakti Yoga. But 7.1 is, Krishna is telling, the same destination. Mai asakta manaha. How can this be achieved? Krishna says, I'll tell you another process. And that process, he says, is, it's Bhakti Yoga. So this is here. Krishna starts describing the process of Bhakti Yoga over here, in this section. Now, what is Krishna doing? What am I trying to do now? How Krishna introduces the Bhakti Yoga and how this 12th chapter, which seems so short, if the Bhakti Yoga is the most, the central, the conclusive message of the Gita, then why is this chapter in one sense so short? And yet, if it is so short, how is it significant? That is what we are trying to understand through this whole discussion. So in the 7th chapter, Krishna, there are remarkable similarities between the 7th and the 9th chapters. Generally, the practice of Bhakti Yoga is centered on the object of devotion. So, if we move forward now, chapters say, this is 7 to 12. Then, in these chapters, what Krishna is doing is, he starts by describing his own glories, his own supreme position. Because that is vital for someone to be able to fix the mind on the Lord. Why should I fix my mind on someone? What is the point of it? How is that person worthy of my devotion? So, 7th chapter is knowledge of Krishna. I'm just putting K dash as knowledge. Knowledge of Krishna. And then after that, we have the 8th chapter is actually where Krishna answers Arjuna's question. Krishna here basically proves how Bhakti Yoga is better than Dhyan Yoga. He says the key point is to remember me at the time of death. And then he says, Om Ityekaksharam Brahma Vyaharan Mama Smaran. That how, by chanting the syllable Om, the yogi is Yoga Balena Chaive, Bhaktya Yukto Yoga Balena Chaive, Prayana Kale Manasa Chalena. So he said, at the time of death, they make their mind fixed. So, Achalena. Arjuna has earlier said that the mind is Chanchala. Krishna says, no, by yoga practice, you can make it Achala, you can make it unmoving, fixed. And Achalena, when you do that, and how will that happen? Yoga Bhaktya Yukto Yoga Balena Chaive. So he's saying, this is yoga practice. But that yoga practice has to be infused with devotion. In the Patanjali Yoga Sutra also, he talks about how Ishvara Pranidhana, or how that's very important limb. So one needs bhakti. But then in the 8th chapter, a very critical verse is the 14th verse, where Krishna says, Krishna is talking about, yes, in the start of the 8th chapter, he says, you remember me at the time of death. Then he says, how can you remember me? One is by practicing Dhyan Yoga. The other, he says, Ananya Chetaha Satatam Yomam Smarati Nityashaha Tasyaham Sulabha Partha Nityayuktasya Yoginaha. So this word Sulabha is the only place in the Bhagavad Gita where it is used. And what does Sulabha means? Labha is Labha, attain. Su is easily. So easily attainable. So this is where Krishna, what he's doing is, he's contrasting Bhakti Yoga and Dhyan Yoga, and he's establishing Bhakti Yoga as the recommended path. So the concern that Arjuna has raised in 6:32-33, when he says the mind is very restless, Krishna says, the way to deal with it is by practicing Bhakti Yoga. And then, it's 9th to 10th chapter if we consider, this is also knowledge of Krishna. But, this, as I mentioned, 7th and 9th chapters are similar, but in the 9th chapter, Krishna explores the concepts more deeply. In the 7th chapter, the focus is more on the object of devotion. In the 9th chapter, the focus is more on the process of devotion. That means, Krishna talks about his own glories, but if you see, there is not much direct reference to bhakti itself in the 7th chapter. But in the 9th chapter, we'll see, from text 22 onwards till 34, it's all about bhakti. So here the focus is on object of devotion. Here the focus is on process of devotion. So in this way, Krishna is shifting. He's developing the subject. Sometimes some speakers keep speaking the same point again and again. If you are hearing attentively, may say, if you're not hearing very attentively, you say, okay, the same point is being repeated. But if you hear attentively, oh, this point is being developed in this way now. This point is being presented from this perspective. This point is explained. Oh, okay. So Krishna seems to address the same themes. He talks about the theme of impersonalism. He talks about the theme of the worship of the devatas. Many themes are similar in the 7th and the 9th chapter. But Krishna is going much deeper in the 9th chapter. Then Krishna gives a specific resource to Arjuna, that is Vibhuti. Like this I discussed yesterday. How can Arjuna remember Krishna in the world? So, what is happening over there is you are not going to turn away from the world to remember me. You have to engage in the world. So, how can you remember me in the world? That's what is discussed in the 10th chapter. So, Vibhuti is, the whole purpose of the chapter is to provide Arjuna aids for remembering Krishna in the world. Katham vidyamaham yogim swatutsta parichintayan keshu keshu cha bhaveshu. That was I quoted yesterday. Then yesterday, what we discussed was the 11th chapter. The Vishwarup, we already discussed what is the significance of that. That is basically to reinforce the conviction that this object of devotion, which seems like just an ordinary two-handed form, that is actually the supreme form. That is a supreme worshipable object. See, for strengthening devotion, what is primarily required is conviction about the glory, even the supremacy of the object of devotion. So there is sadhan and there is sadhya. So we need to be convinced. If you're going to take another example, if we are sick, it's a severe sickness. Now what we need is there is a doctor and there is a treatment. Now to some extent we need faith in both. We need to be convinced about the expertise of the doctor. And we need to be convinced about the potency of the treatment. And if both of these are there, then we will take the treatment wholeheartedly. So similarly, in these 6 chapters, Krishna is doing those 2 things. Krishna is establishing his own supreme position. This is Krishna's position. Krishna is like the doctor over here. And then the treatment is Bhakti Yoga. And this is what is needed for seekers. So Krishna, in one sense, is doing his whole purpose is to establish the conviction that Arjuna should practice bhakti and engage devotion, that is fighting in the world. That's how he needs to practice bhakti. So this is where the 11th chapter comes up. Now, with this broad background, all this can seem a little technical, but I'm assuming that most of us have studied the Bhagavad Gita. And so, it's fascinating actually. It's like, you'll see that jigsaw puzzle pieces fall in place. Once you start understanding, why is this coming over here? What is going on over there in the Gita? So now we come to the 12th chapter. So Krishna has basically done 2 things. Established the glory of the process of devotion and the glory of the object of devotion. So now Arjuna's question at one level seems a bit disjointed. If you see, The 11th chapter is about the universal form. And the 12th chapter, it is, this is say 1 to 55, and this is 1 to 20. And at least the first 7 verses, they are about the impersonal versus personal. So that question suddenly seems to be coming out of nowhere. It doesn't seem to be directly related with what has been spoken previously. Just on the universal form was talked about. But the idea here is, Arjuna is not necessarily always asking questions based on what was just recently spoken. Arjuna is also living, see, Krishna, Arjuna's questions, the Bhagavad Gita actually, there are 17 questions. And very interesting, those 17 questions. And they can be understood at a very universal level. So each of those 17 questions, where it comes from and how it is answered, the answer is relevant for us. It's a fascinating study. I've done several courses on this and I hope to write a book in future on this. But the point is that Arjuna's questions come from 3 different sources. Arjuna's questions, 17 questions. One comes from his personal context. That's the starting question. You know, he is on the battlefield and he is fighting and he is undecided. Should I fight or not? That's the basic driving question of the Gita. The second comes from the textual context. Textual context means that what Krishna has spoken previously, based on that Arjuna is asking a question. But the third is more from the general context. So personal context, the example could be 2.7. It could also be 6.32-33, what I mentioned. Hey, what you're saying is very difficult. I can't practice this. Textual context means, we can look at 4.4. Krishna says that, I have given this knowledge to the Suryadev. And I say, wait a minute. You are much younger to Suryadev. How could you have given this knowledge to him? So what he has spoken previously, based on that, the question is coming. But there are some questions which come, they come from a very general context. General context means, sometimes if we hear a class from a speaker, and we find that that speaker is very articulate, very logical, very understandable, then we may have some question in our mind which is not related with the class directly. But it is a question that we have. So then we will naturally ask that question. So especially 13.1, that is a question which does not come from directly what Arjuna has spoken. Arjuna has heard from Krishna. And they're asking about the term kshetra, kshetrajna, jnana, jnaya. These are not terms which Arjuna has heard Krishna use in the Gita. Some of them, jnana is very common. But kshetra and kshetrajna, Arjuna has not heard Krishna use them in the Gita anywhere till then. But Arjuna uses this because Arjuna's point is, Krishna, you've given me this worldview. You've given me this way of looking at things. But this is what I know from before. So in your worldview, in your teachings, how does this fit in? How did this fit in? Arjuna lived not in a spiritually ignorant culture. He had also interacted with many sages throughout his life. And he had heard spiritual wisdom. So Arjuna is trying to put that together. So with that background, the question, evam satata yuktaye bhaktastvam paripasate. So let's see where this question comes from. So where is this coming from? That is, Krishna's purpose is to establish the supremacy of the object of devotion. So one is, there is the materially all-pervasive form. So if you want to compare Krishna, which is greater? Is Krishna, we could compare Krishna with the materially all-pervasive divinity. That is the universal form. Let's keep it divine. That is the universal form. And this is discussed in chapter 11. So what is the relationship of that? Now Krishna, after Krishna categorically says that his two-handed form is higher than the materially universal, materially all-pervasive form. Then Arjuna asks, okay, the universal form is material and all-pervasive, but there is also a spiritually all-pervasive divinity. And that is Brahman. So, what is its relationship with you? So in that sense, it's more not a textual leap as a conceptual link. It is, okay, you said that universal form is greater than this personal form is greater than universal form. Then that universal form is all pervading at a material level. But what about what is all pervading at the spiritual level? That is the Brahman. So if somebody is worshipping Brahman and somebody is worshipping you, somebody is devoted to Brahman and somebody is devoted to you, so among these two, which is better? So let's look at some of the verses here. Okay. So let's recite this verse. Is it visible to everyone? Okay, this can't be increased. Shri Bhagavanuvacha. Maya Veshamano Ye Mam. Nitya Yukta Upasate. Shraddhaya Parayo Petas. Teme Yukta Tamamataha. So here Arjuna has asked, if you look at this literal wording of the question, Satata Yuktaye Bhaktas Tvam Paripasate. And Krishna's wording is Mai Avesh Manoyam Nitya Yukta Upasate. Satata yukta, nitya yukta. So what Krishna is talking about is very, very clear. He's talking about the first category of people. Arjuna's question is that if we have, so who is better? So Arjuna's question is that are the impersonalists who worship your impersonal Brahman better, or those who worship the personal divinity, the personal form better? So Arjuna's question is, and Krishna very clearly says, this is what they are yuktatama. They are much more, they're most intimately united with me. Like good, better and best. Krishna is not saying the other is bad, but it is a superlative. Yuktatama, yukta, yuktatara, yuktatama. And then in one verse, he gives the categorical answer. And then after that, he talks about the other category. And it's interesting, the other category of people, Krishna describes them in detail. This is a significant point to which I'll come back to as we move forward. He describes first the conception that they have. Yetvakshanam anirdesham avyaktam paripasate. And then all that, their conception, he says, te prapnuvanti mameva. Even they attain me. So it's interesting, Krishna is saying that even those who worship the Brahman, they attain, he's not saying the Brahman, they attain me. Te prapnuvanti mameva. And further he uses sarva bhuta hite rataha. They are engaged in the welfare of all living beings. So here Krishna is not downplaying the destination. Krishna is not Krishna is not minimizing the seekers in the verse at literal realities. He appreciates both. So now the acharyas here, there is a question that if somebody is worshipping the impersonal, how will they attain Krishna? If they are seeking the Brahman, they are meditating on the Brahman. Now, how will they attain Krishna? So, see, from Krishna's perspective, this is, Jiva Goswami talks about this elaborately in the Sandarbhas. So, see, we can look at it as, from Krishna's perspective, the absolute truth is one. Now, within the absolute truth, we can have Bhagavan, Paramatma, and Brahman. But now these are not three distinct beings. Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are the same absolute truth. Tattvam yad jnanam advayam. The three are non-different. The difference is from our level of perception. How, from Krishna's perspective, they are all one absolute truth. From our perspective, so this is the divine, human perspective, it depends on how much we are perceiving. So when we perceive only the Sat aspect of the, so the seeker turns towards the eternal and perceives only the sat aspect of the eternal. Sat means, oh, beyond this changing material world, there is something that is unchanging, that exists forever. And I want to attain that. So when we realize the eternal only in terms of the sat aspect, that realization, that level of realization is called as Brahman. When we realize the ultimate reality in terms of sat and chit, that is called as Paramatma. The Paramatma is not literally dancing in joy. The Paramatma is not performing Rasleela. The Paramatma is not playing with the cowherd boys. The Paramatma is Udaseena Vadaseenam, is sitting gravely detached. Now, when we realize the Sat, Chit and Ananda, all three aspects, that is when we realize Bhagavan. Or that level of realization is called Bhagavan. Or, just to ask, I think I must have explained this earlier, but with this visual it might become clearer. Say, if we have some, which is a delicacy that also has a good fragrance. Say, let's consider something like a gulab jamun. So now if you see, generally for delicacy, the first thing it may attract us is by its smell, its fragrance. It's not semi-final, it is smell of fragrance. Okay, this case, let's keep it smell. Then, after that, we look at it and, hey, where is this beautiful fragrance coming from? We get captivated by it. And then we move forward and we see its form. Sorry. The form. Hey, this nicely formed spherical balls are there over here. Oh, that's nice. And then we experience the taste. We eat it. Oh, this is so delicious. So now that object is the same gulab jamun. But it is perceived, or different features of that object are perceived. Now imagine a situation where somebody who knows only the fragrance of the gulab jamun, they never eaten the gulab jamun, but just the fragrance itself is so nice. And that is all that they know. You know, I pass by this shop, and when I pass by the shop, I smell this fragrance and I love it. And they give a name to that object. Whatever object has that fragrance, they give some name to it. Then somebody, while passing by, they say, oh, there is a transparent window over here. And they say, hey, this object looks also very good. So if we had a name, one, for the object based on how we perceive it, only its smell. Then we have name two. That is, for the object, how it is smelt and how it is seen. And then we have name three. For how it is smelt, seen and tasted. So there are three names, but the object is the same. Now, are the three names interchangeable? Well, yes and no. The three names are interchangeable in the sense that all the three are names of the same object. However, the three names are not interchangeable if we are focusing on what is the level of perception of that object. So from our perspective, from when we are analyzing as seekers on the spiritual path, we differentiate between Brahman realization, Paramatma realization, Bhagavan realization. But from Krishna's perspective, these three are not different. From Krishna's perspective, these three are actually referring to the same absolute truth. So what happens is that, actually, in the Krishna Bhavanamrut Mahakavya, there's a similar incident described with respect to Krishna itself. Now, when Radharani, she has not met Krishna. You know, they used to see each other at festivals, other times when they're small children. But then all of them, Krishna on one side in Vrindavan, and Radharani on the other side in Barsana, they come to their teenage year, they come to their youth, early youth. And then the Purva Rag gets awakened. So what happens is, Radharani, she's just going through the Barsana forest nearby, and she smells the fragrance of Krishna. And when she smells the fragrance of Krishna, she says, you know, she's so captivated by it that itself conquers her heart.
He said, oh, who is this such an attractive person?
No, people nowadays wear all kinds of perfumes and colognes to try to attract others. So Krishna doesn't have to wear that. Krishna's body has a captivating natural fragrance. And she feels, oh, my heart is lost. I've fallen in love with this person. And then, after that, she hears Krishna's flute. Or rather, she hears a flute sound. A flute song. And it is so intoxicating that she's, oh, this person is so wonderful. She feels her heart going irresistibly toward that person. Now, she doesn't know that the person with that attractive fragrance and that person with this captivating flute song are the same person. She starts thinking, what kind of fickle woman am I? I'm being attracted to two different men. And then after that, she sees Krishna. She sees the form. But when she sees Krishna's form, she sees it from a distance. So at that time, she does not see the smell, the fragrance. And at that time, Krishna is not playing the flute. So when she sees Krishna's form, she says, oh, this person is so attractive. And she falls in love with that person. And then she is berating herself. She's thinking, what kind of woman am I? I have fallen in love with three different men. And then finally, when they're having a festival and she smells that fragrance. Oh, who's this person? I've never seen this person. And then she hears Krishna is coming from the forest back. So she smells the fragrance and then she hears the flute. Oh, she says, both of them are coming here. She becomes a little nervous. And then as she comes closer and she catches sight of, oh, this is Krishna. Oh, he's the third person. Then she sees he's playing the flute. And as he comes closer, she smells the fragrance. And her heart becomes filled with both relief and joy. That actually, that I'm not loving three people, I'm loving the same one person. And he has these three attributes, which each one of them has separately conquered my heart. So this is the devotional level. Angani asa sakalendri vittimanti. You know, Krishna can do everything with every one of his senses. Krishna can capture the heart of his devotee by even one of the sense perception that he offers. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is said that he is the complete sense object. He is the ultimate sense object. So similarly, from what we need to understand is, from one perspective, at the level of our experience, Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan are different. Based on our level of realization. But from Krishna's perspective, Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan are the same one person. They're one absolute truth, one reality. So when Krishna is saying, they prapnuvanti mam eva, they are attaining me. So, with this particular framework, why did I go into this whole thing? See, this is the absolute truth. This is Bhagavan, this is Paramatma, and this is Brahman. So when Krishna is saying, here in 12.2, 12.34, te prapnuvanti mam eva. So at one level, he's talking about they will attain the spiritual reality. But actually, they're not just attaining spiritual reality, they're attaining the Brahman aspect of spiritual reality. From Krishna's perspective, he and Brahman are not different. It is the same thing. It's his own effulgence. They will attain me. But so if they were literally attaining him only, in the sense that they were attaining Bhagavan, then Krishna wouldn't have said the first category as Yukta Tama. He says, they are most intimately united with me because they know me the fullest. So 12.2, when he talks about it, that is, they are attaining the Bhagavan aspect. The 12.4, te prapnuvanti maveva, they are attaining the Brahman aspect. And when they are attaining that, Krishna, then the next part, he says that, but, so if they are attaining you only in some aspect, then what is the problem with it? The problem is, the process is very difficult. Klesho adhiktarastesham avyakta asakta chetasam. Let's look at the verse quickly. You can recite this verse. We can do it together. Klesho adhiktarastesham avyakta asakta chetasam avyakta hi gatir dukkham dehavadbhir avapyate. So, klesho adhiktarastesham. It's a lot of klesho. Now, in English, there's a figure of speech called onomatopoeia. What it means is that the word, the sound of the word itself indicates the action of the emotion. So, klesha, the word itself indicates some amount of jarring sound is there in it. So klesha, it's not just dukkha, klesha. Klesha, the word sounds harsher than dukkha. So klesha adhiktaras. There's a lot of difficulty, a lot of distress on this path. Avyakta asakta chetasam. So it's interesting, Krishna using the word asakti. Remember this chapter, or this section of the Gita started with mai asakta manaha. So here he's saying, instead of being mai avesha manoyam, which he used over here, but if somebody is avyakta asakta chetasam, if they prefer the impersonal, they prefer the unmanifested reality, then their path is difficult. Avyakta hi gatir dukkham. So their progress, it's in Krishna uses actually dukkha and klesha both in the same verse. So the idea is that the process is difficult and progress is also difficult. The two things which is called. The overall process is difficult. But sometimes you want to climb up a mountain and we can go slowly by a gentle path, or we can just climb up the mountain from a steep cliff. The process is much more difficult, but you could say the progress is faster. If you can actually scale the cliff, then maybe you can get up to the mountain in 5 minutes. If you're going to go by the path, it may take you 1 hour to go slowly up. So in this climbing up the mountain from the cliff, the process is difficult, but the progress is fast. But here Krishna is saying, both the process is difficult and the progress is also difficult. Progress is also slow, it's laborious. That's why there's twice the word, klesha and dukkha. And then Krishna contrasts this. Remember, the whole purpose of this Bhakti Yoga chapter section is, Bhakti Yoga section is to reinforce Arjuna's conviction in the practice of bhakti. So after telling that this impersonal is difficult, then what does Krishna do? The same points. There is process and there is progress. So for both, with respect to the impersonal, he says this is difficult, this is distressing, or difficult, whatever word you want to use, distressing. Now after that, this is both are there in 12.5. Now for the personal, there's a contrast directly in the next verse. And what are the next verse talk about? The process and the progress. Let's look at that. Let's recite this together. Let's recite the last second part of the verse. Teshamaham samudharta mrityu samsara sagarat bhavami na chirat partha maya veshita chetasam. So he says the progress will be rapid because aham samudharta, I will deliver. And how will I deliver? Na chirat. Not a long time, soon. Prabhupada translates this as, I am the swift deliverer. Swift is a very sweet word actually. Swift, it's not fast, indicates haste. Come fast. You're running, stressing yourself to come. But swift indicates, it's almost like effortless speed. It's like a swift drive. It's a swift vehicle. So airplane is a swift mode of transportation. So it's not that the driver is huffing and puffing to try to take us faster. The pilot is just sitting and it's swift. So I'm the swift deliverer. So Krishna says the progress is fast. And then the process itself is what? We are fixing the mind on Krishna. We're dedicating our actions to Krishna. First of all, we can do actions. You know, in impersonal, when we're attached to the impersonal, the big problem is that everything that we think about is Maya. So what do we think about? We have to think about the Brahman means we have to practically stop all thought and then think about that which is beyond thought. That is very difficult. It's impossible. But even if somebody says it's possible, it's very difficult. Whereas thinking about Krishna, acting for Krishna is relatively easier. And in that way, what Krishna is doing is he is saying the progress is swift. Na chirat. And process is, relatively speaking, easy. Because there is a variety of, we can do activities, it's not inactive, and then there is the Lord who has attributes. So it's very easy to remember him. know if this is visible. Sorry about the crowding. So we can do activities. Yetu sarvani karmani. Krishna says, all your work you can do, but you can do it in your devotion to me. And mai aveshita chita. So you fix your mind on me. So there could not be a more resounding way which Krishna could have actually emphasized his recommendation of the practice of bhakti yoga. Then Krishna is so beautifully developing this subject. Somebody may say that, yeah, but you know, fixing the mind on you is quite difficult. I can't do it. Then Krishna offers a descending ladder of love. He says, bhakti yoga itself, somebody may say, oh, you know, I don't have enough devotion. So I can't practice bhakti yoga. I can't fix the mind on the Lord. So Krishna says, Krishna offers what is a descending ladder of love. He says, yes, even if you're not at that level, you can practice it at multiple levels. So most of us probably know the verses. I'll quickly go through this level and then I'll go to the last part. So eighth verse, Krishna talks about the highest level, that mind and intelligence absorbed in Krishna. He says, if you do this, it's amazing what Krishna is saying. Mayaiva mana adhatsva mai buddhim niveshaya nivasishyasi mayaiva atardhamna samshaya. He's saying, it is not that you will attain me in future. You're already with me. You're already residing in me. That's the eighth verse. Then in the ninth verse, he says, again, he doesn't use the word mind and intelligence, but he focuses, atha chittam samadhatum na shaknosi maisira abhyasa yogindato mam icchaptum dhananjaya. So here he is talking about practice for focusing. So practice for, generally when you use the word concentration. See, there's a difference between concentration and absorption. Generally, concentration indicates some effort. I'm trying to concentrate on this. But absorption means it's effortless. I've forgotten that anything else exists also. I'm just completely immersed in it. So Krishna is recommending concentration over here. Okay. If your mind is naturally absorbed, wonderful. If you can't, just make effort. And by that effort, what will happen is, you will develop your desire for me. And once we have developed a desire, then what will happen is, then naturally we'll become absorbed. Now, if we like something, we don't have to concentrate. Like if somebody makes a movie. I mentioned this earlier, that I was in America once. The devotees organized a program for me in one college. So while I was going to the college, I asked, what is the name of the college? It says, American Institute of Illusion. That was the name, Institute of Illusion. The idea is that that's where they make movies. So one of the most scathing ways you can criticize a movie review, a movie, you can say, if you're reviewing a movie, you know, I had to concentrate to watch the movie. A movie should not require concentration. A movie should be so entertaining that it actually draws you inside. So the point is that is because we may not identify with the characters, we may not desire to watch it. So if desire is there, naturally absorption will come. So Krishna says, from concentration, absorption will come. But if somebody says, I cannot even do that. And he says, okay, then you can just act for me. Okay, you can't fix your mind on the particular thing. You can't do, you can't chant, you can't hear. Krishna says, just do seva. So the first we could say from the bhakti perspective, this is the state of samadhi. I'm using yoga terminology over here. This is the stage of sadhana. Then this is the stage of seva. That sometimes when we are trying to introduce people to bhakti, sometimes we make bhakti like a 1-0 package. Take it all or give it all up. But people, that is not Krishna's approach. Like somebody may want to come to the temple and do some seva. They may like to serve prasadam. They may like to clean the temple. But tell them and sit and hear a class. Or tell them, chant 16 rounds. And then yad gatvana nivartante. They'll go and never come back. So, yeah, we want to encourage everyone to take up the process of bhakti more and more. But Krishna accepts people at different levels. So if somebody just wants to come and do some seva, then Krishna accepts that. In fact, you will see that if you look at Srila Prabhupada, how he engaged people, basically during Prabhupada's times, there were two broad demographics that were there. There were his Western disciples and there were the Indian life members. And we will see that Prabhupada, in his discussion with the Indian life members, he's practically never pushing them, you have to get initiated, He's not telling them that you have to chant 16 rounds. He's engaging the Indian life members at the level of seva. That is 10.10. And his Western disciples, or those who are committing himself, he's engaging them at the level of sadhana. He's insisting very strongly, you know, do this, follow the morning program, do this, do that. So Prabhupada was very inclusive. Now he provided the life members also the pathway that they can come and stay in the temple and they can rise up from there. They can get experience the temple life and they will have books. So they can come to the level of sadhana. But Prabhupada accepted them. Now, if you see today, most of our movement exists in between. We have congregation. The congregation is much more dedicated than the life members. But the congregation not full-time devotees who are in the temple. We can't expect them to follow the same level of sadhana, the full morning program, which say somebody who's living in the temple can follow. So we are in one sense an uncharted territory. And we have to be as resourceful as Krishna is in engaging people according to what level they feel comfortable at. So then after that, Krishna says in the 11th verse, so this is at least, we could say, Bhagavat Seva. The service to me. But then after that, Krishna says, just Seva. That is also, he says that, just sacrifice the fruits of your work. And we see today, in today's world, there is this activism and volunteering is a huge thing. People are very big into this thing. They want to feel that I am doing something bigger than myself. So people may volunteer for some volunteer for some noble cause, maybe environmental activism, animal care. So Christianity is very, very good in leveraging this. You know, there are several Christian groups in America. They say that, you know, just give 2 years of your life to God. And what are the 2 years of your life? You say, go on missionary work. Mainly they go to Africa. And they have, nowadays there's a word that is used called poverty porn. Porn is generally used with sexuality, but the word has become now universalized. Anywhere there is very strong visual imagery intended to create a certain effect. That is called as porn. So you can have violence porn. They like them very bloody, gory kind of thing. So poverty porn means that you show images of people who are abjectly poor. And then you see that, you know, you see kids with like matchstick-like arms and bloated bellies and sunken faces, small 3, 4, 5-year-old children. Then anybody will be inspired to give charity. So they show pictures like this. And I'm not saying it's a manipulative way, but that's how they attract people. And there are little thousands and thousands of young people who go on missionary work to Africa. Some of them come to India also, but India is growing. So they don't get that sense of, I'm helping poor people. They'll go to tribal areas. And these people, they come for 2 years and they stay and they go back. Some of them stay on. So the idea is a lot of people have the spirit to volunteer. Now, some of those people who come for these kind of activities, they're not even interested in Jesus. They're interested in humanitarian work. But they see that actually Christians are doing this humanitarian work. And then they become more devoted Christians. So, and I was talking with His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj about Western outreach. I was asking him about GV and the vision for it. So he told me many times, each time when I ask him about it, he tells me different things. So one of the things he said is, we want to provide as many opportunities as possible for people to associate with devotees in a non-preaching setting. That's a very important part, he says. Non-preaching setting. The number of people who will want to come and hear about Krishna, hear philosophy, they are there, but they are limited. But somebody comes and does something with us. They garden with us. They do some eco-friendly work with us. They go and just offer some food to poor people. They do some kind of activity, even they do yoga with us. They associate with devotees and say, hey, these devotees are nice people, they're doing good work. I want to know more about them. I want to become like them. So this volunteering spirit, somebody can say, it's just mundane. It is just philanthropy. It is just humanitarian work. Well, it is not just. Because those who are doing this, they are at least above the level of sense gratification. Or just immediate gross sense gratification. And that is ennobling, that is uplifting. So Krishna includes that. And he says, even if you can't connect with me at all, still connect with some higher cause. Now, the 12th verse is very confusing. We'll need a whole class to explain what the 12th verse is. But overall, Krishna is offering multiple levels. And we could say that Krishna's message over here is something like this. Is this visible? I don't know how the color changed. So it is, from your place, wherever you are, from your place, at your pace, access my grace. So, Krishna is very inclusive. From your place. Okay, this is where, like Prabhupada's life members, they're at their place. They're well situated in society. They had no intention of renouncing the world. Prabhupada, before going to America, had asked, you know, families to just give one son. You have five sons, give one child to me. Prabhupada, when he came back, he didn't make that request to the life members too much. He realized they're not going to follow that. From your place, at your pace, but connect with me, access my grace. So here, Krishna is actually showing, although in one sense this chapter is very small, it is power-packed. It first very categorically establishes the supremacy of bhakti, the paramount position of bhakti over impersonal worship or impersonal meditation. Then it talks about how bhakti is multi-level. And the last part is, again, these three sections can sometimes seem a little disjointed. From 12, 13 to 20, Krishna is talking about qualities that endear a devotee to him. Yomad bhaktaha same priyaha. Bhaktiman yaha same priyaha. This is what Krishna talks about. But what is significant about this is Krishna does not mention a single devotional activity which will endear a devotee to him. Krishna does not say that one who chants the holy names is dear to me. Krishna doesn't say one who hears Bhagavatam is dear to me. Krishna doesn't say that one who is worshipping the deities is dear to me. All the attributes that Krishna is talking about are what we can say as human or sattvic attributes. It is Advaishta Sarvabhutana, Maitra Karuna Evacha. He's non-envious, friendly, forgiving, steady. Yasman no dvijate loko, lokan no dvijate chaya. One who does not disturb others and one who is not disturbed by others. So what does this mean? This means that in this particular context, what Krishna is doing is something very striking. Krishna is emphasizing to Arjuna that while there can be many different kinds of devotees, the devotees that are especially dear to him are the devotees who engage responsibly in the world. They engage responsibly. They are competent. They are committed. So the idea is that Krishna doesn't talk about, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's no mention at all anywhere of, say, dancing in ecstasy. Dancing in ecstasy is wonderful. But we have to always remember that the Gita is spoken at a particular time to a particular person. So if we consider Arjuna's context, there's one academic scholar, he said that actually ISKCON's two books, main books, Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, you know, they are completely different. Why? Because he says the Gita's bhakti and the Bhagavatam's bhakti, there is no similarity between the two of them. He says the Bhagavatam's bhakti is centered on, especially if you go for the Chaitanya Charitamrita's bhakti, it's all about ecstasy. And there's no mention of ecstasy. In the Bhagavad Gita, you will not find much reference of deity worship also. With chanting of the holy names, you can find one or two verses, Satatam Kirtayantoma. We don't find much. So, he says that it's so different that actually there's no commonality. Well, that is a very external understanding. The principle of remembrance of Krishna is very consistent in the Bhagavatam, in the Bhagavad Gita, and Chaitanya Charitamrita. And that is the essence of bhakti. But the context is different. In the context, it's engaging with the world. It is renouncing the world. So, see, Arjuna has a responsibility to do, and therefore the focus is get Arjuna to do the responsibility. But Parikshit Maharaj has already decided, I've accepted the curse, I'm going to die, I've renounced the world. Then for him, renounce devotion is what he's talking about. The devotion is the same, but the application is opposite because the context is opposite. What is required in the context is opposite. So the Gita's devotion, because of the Arjuna's context, it is, so here, we could say the, in the Bhagavatam, and especially the CC, the bhakti is very emotional. My God, I don't know how much is visible to all of you. Whereas the Gita's bhakti is relatively unemotional. Unemotional, as I said, it's not talking much about ecstasy. Why? Because in Arjuna's context, his emotions were coming in the way. It is his emotions at the start of the Gita that had sabotaged him, that had prevented him from acting responsibly. And therefore, Krishna's overall message in the Gita is that while bhakti is a path of emotion, but for this particular service, you have to restrain your emotions. So it's a contextual emphasis. So Arjuna, on the battlefield, if he's to do, he's to act in the mood of service, if we are in general going to act in the world, no, we cannot be in ecstasy. We have to be purposeful, we have to be focused. We see Prabhupada's example. It is rare moments when Prabhupada would be in ecstasy. We could say at one level, Prabhupada is always in ecstasy. But manifest ecstasy, Prabhupada did not just start dancing and go into trances. Prabhupada was very aware, very attentive. Because service in the world requires us to be in the world. Just to be responsible. So all the attributes that Krishna is talking about in this section are attributes that are helpful for a devotee for functioning in the world. And Krishna is saying, these are the attributes that will endear a devotee to me. Various devotees are dear, all devotees are dear to Krishna. But those devotees who assist Krishna in his mission in the world by taking up responsibilities here, by functioning responsibly over here, he says, they are especially dear to me. And in this way, what Krishna does is in these three sections, I'll conclude with this point, what we discussed today. I first started by the 12th chapter, how the 12th chapter is significant in the middle six chapters. So from Krishna is shooting the arrow at the bullseye from multiple perspectives. So in the 7th chapter, it is knowledge of the object of devotion. That is the focus. Then the same bullseye is being hit in the 8th, this is chapter 7. Then in chapter 8, the bullseye is hit by talking about how bhakti yoga is greater than dhyan yoga. The same bullseye is being hit in the 9th chapter by talking about the knowledge of the process of devotion. That is the emphasis in that chapter. Then in the 10th chapter, that how to remember Krishna in the world. That is vibhuti. That is the arrow is being hit. Now, somebody says bhakti is impractical. You know, you'll have to renounce the world. You'll just be chanting Hare Krishna constantly and you'll not be doing anything functional. No, bhakti means you should be able to see Krishna in the world. That is the bullseye is hitting. Then the 11th chapter is, you know, the Krishna's form might not seem very awe-inspiring. The universal form is awe-inspiring. But Krishna says that actually the 11th chapter of the bullseye arrow is that the two-handed form is greater than the universal form. And the 12th chapter, the bullseye is being hit by saying that the two-handed form, the personal form, is greater than the impersonal Brahman. Worshipping that. So this is how Krishna is, in multiple ways, reinforcing the message of the glory of bhakti. That's what he earlier does. For we're taking all the paths and focusing on how action has to be performed. But now, within this chapter, there are three sections. And these three sections, say if we consider 1 to 7, that emphasizes this specific time that personal is greater than impersonal. And then 7 to, we could say, sorry, let's put this, yeah, till 12, this is talking about the multi-level nature of bhakti. You can connect anywhere. And then last section is about how bhakti can actually make us more effective. That if a person is calm, if a person is not agitated and not agitating, a person is compassionate, person is forgiving, then that person, even in the material world, they'll be able to function with far greater effectiveness. So in this way, Krishna very strongly brings out the message that Arjuna, just practice bhakti. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Is there any one quick question? Yes, bro. Behind you. Just speak it, I'll repeat.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Prabhuji, for a very nice explanation. I have two questions. When you say that the impersonal attain the Brahma, attain the Brahman, so what is that state and what they are doing there? Is there any form or not? Or what is the activities there? Second question is that the last point that Lord says.
Okay, let's take one question at a time. Let's see. So what do the impersonalists do in the Brahman? Well, actually, Brahman, it's non-differentiated oneness. Sometimes people say that the idea is that, say, this is the soul and this is God. And then let's put God as much bigger. Sorry. And this is God. So, a common misunderstanding, or we could say this is sometimes called a Neo-Mayavad, the new version of Mayavad. They say that the soul and God become one. You will become God. Or there's a famous Mayavadi teacher who says that. In the past, many gurus came and said that I am God. But he says, I have come to give you a different message. I have not come to say I am God. I come to tell you are God. So, but the idea is, now if you look at serious Mayavadis, they laugh at this. They say, this is not our philosophy at all. Because their idea is not that we will become God, but rather their idea is this Brahman is like a non-differentiated reality. Okay, let me just go down over here. Sorry. Let's put it here. Their idea is that this Brahman is an infinite non-differentiated reality. And from Brahman, somehow the soul falls. And from Brahman, God emerges. This is God or Ishvara, as we call it. So their idea is not that the soul will become God. Rather, in the liberated stage, what will happen is, this is reversed. So temporarily, while we are in this world, we can meditate on God, and that is good. But after that, what will happen is, the bhakti understanding is, both of these will have a eternal, this is the bhakti understanding, the eternal loving relationship. And in fact, the Brahman is lower than Bhagwan. But their understanding is, in the liberated state, the soul will initially meditate on God, and the soul will realize that I am an illusion and God is an illusion. And then this, they will merge into it. So the idea is not that the soul becomes God, but the idea of God is an illusion, the idea of the self is also an illusion. Nothing exists except Brahman. So in that state, there is simply existence. There is no activity. There is no reciprocation. In fact, the idea of activity and reciprocation itself is meaningless because there is just existence. So their understanding is normally that this is a person and this is some sense object. And there is the stream of consciousness. Stream of consciousness that goes from the person to sense object. So our understanding, the bhakti understanding is, the stream of consciousness is impure. It's filled with lust, it's greed, anger, and that's what causes problems. And we need to purify how we see the world. But their idea of liberation, of pure consciousness, is that the sense object is an illusion, this person is an illusion. So all that exists is the stream of consciousness. That's why there is no activity, there is just existence. That's the understanding of Brahman liberation. Okay? Descending ladder of love, yeah. Okay, good question. Good question. See, if somebody is, say, doing some kind of social welfare work, but either they are, if there is social welfare, which could be directly anti-God, or we could say it could be anti-Vedic culture, because they are the anti-Vedas. So what is their destination? Well, generally there are two ways of looking at things. The Bhagavad Gita doesn't offer just one way. One is that we think of things in terms of three modes. So there is tamas, rajas, sattva. Now, and then of course ultimately there is shuddha sattva, but that is mostly inaccessible for most people. So from this perspective, if a person is doing philanthropic work, doing social service, they are to some extent sattvic. Put their motivations aside. Their activity is sattvic. We need to consider their motivations, but we don't have to consider the motivations alone. Just like if somebody is a doctor, that doctor may not really be interested in caring for people. Doctor is just interested in earning money. But if the doctor is doing the job well, then the doctor is helping, contributing to society. So now, of course, if the doctor is also having a deep concern for patients, that's even better. But the point is that from this perspective, a person who is doing charitable work is better than a person who is not doing it. So this is the one perspective that offers. Then another is that we see Krishna over here, and we see that actually all these are simply mundane. Tamas, rajas, sattva, they are all like horizontal. They are not themselves vertical. They are almost horizontal. And bhakti can lift anyone. Rather, let's put it this way. Krishna's mercy can descend and uplift anyone from anywhere. So Krishna's mercy can descend to a person in tamoguna and uplift them. So there are two ways of looking at it. So from this second perspective, if somebody is in sattva guna, but they're anti-God, then what is happening is, then that is more damaging, because they are taking people away from God. So we can look at it from multiple perspectives rather than putting only one perspective. So if we consider communism, broadly the leftist ideology, that is, they do focus a lot on social justice and social welfare and trying to end discrimination and provide facilities for everyone. There are countries in the West, many Western countries, welfare states, where they often actually take fairly good care of people. So, now are they doing good work? Well, yes. But often these very leftist people, they are atheists. The government is secular, but it often quite overtly, or at least covertly also, promotes atheism. So that part is bad. So things are not just black and white generally. Whenever we want to understand what is the Krishna conscious perspective of this thing, well, Krishna conscious perspective from which direction? From the perspective of helping people immediately, that is nice. They're helping people. But are they making people against Krishna? Well, that is bad. So will people become permanently against Krishna? Maybe, maybe not. Because people change. There's no fixed identity to people, apart from the fact that their souls are parts of Krishna. The person who's an atheist can tomorrow become atheist also. A person who is elevated by philanthropic work done by leftist kind of people, and that person develops, that person becomes, you could say, a good human being, a responsible citizen, a competent person. Maybe at that person, later on, they will encounter devotees doing similar work, and devotees having a better understanding of life, and they may become devotees. Or sometimes they may just have so much visceral hatred towards God that they will never become. So it's very difficult to put one label on something. So if somebody is doing philanthropic work, well, is it good, is it bad? It depends. It depends on what is the overall intent with which they are doing, or the overall effect of what they are doing. Generally, the Mahabharata says that when you want to understand the nature, whether action is good or bad, if you want to understand it, there are three things. We look at the action, we look at the intent of the action, and we look at the effect of the action. And based on these three criteria, we decide whether action is good or bad. So the action itself, let's, instead of putting action, you can put it here as the content of the action. So the content, the intent, and the effect. So from the perspective of the content, yes, what they're doing is good. The intent, well, it depends. The effect, again, it depends. So especially somebody who's causing, say, Christians who are doing conversion, Now they've been taught the belief that their religion is the only one true religion. And many of them genuinely feel they're actually saving people from hell. Their idea is people have only one lifetime. And they don't take this lifetime and they don't come to the saving grace of Jesus. They are going to go to hell forever. So with that idea, after they are indoctrinated with that idea, for them conversion, for some of them it could be just a commercial activity. But for others it could be in their vision it's a compassionate activity. So maybe their intent is good. What about the effect? The effect is people are becoming sometimes deracinated, as they say. They become disconnected from their own culture. They become fragmented from their own family and community. And there is then, of course, religion doesn't exist in isolation. Religion also becomes a source of political power and social disturbance. So all those things also come in. So we'll have to look at all these three factors. We can't just say this is good or bad. So in general, what we can say, somebody is doing social service, then that person has a somewhat evolved consciousness. They're thinking of something bigger than themselves. But whether they're thinking of something bigger than themselves, that will open them to thinking of something bigger than what they're thinking of right now, or that will close them to that. That varies. So that's the broad answer. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Tai Gaura Premanandi.